From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you will hear a conversation with Vermont author Doug Wilhelm, whose new book is Catalysts for Change, How Nonprofits and a Foundation Are Helping Shape Vermont's Future. The book is published by Rootstock. Doug Wilhelm is a former Vermont reporter for the Boston Globe and has been a full-time self-employed writer and editor in Vermont for the past 35 years. He has written 17 books for young readers, including Street of Storytellers, published by Rootstock in 2019, and The Revealers, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux in 2003, which was the focus of reading and discussion projects in over 1,000 schools in the U.S. and internationally. Wilhelm edited and contributed to China in Another Time, published by Rootstock, a memoir by Claire M. Lintilak. He has also written 10 books for the Choose Your Own Adventure series. And I talked to him several years ago about another book that he had written. How do we shift to a clean energy economy, help communities adapt to climate change, and help responsible and local journalism survive? Supported by an activist family foundation and often working closely with it, Vermont nonprofits have played vital roles in making positive progress on these and other complex challenges. The stories in Catalysts for Change tell what these partnerships have achieved and how. The book begins with Claire Malcolm's jarring experience as a newly trained nurse, witnessing unsafe childbirth practices among the poor in China, where she lived and worked for nearly half a century. Widowed and living in Vermont later in life, Claire created the Lintilak Foundation to help bring nurse midwifery back into the American healthcare system in Vermont's largest hospital. Over the decades since Claire's passing in 1984, the foundation, run by her daughter-in-law and son, has expanded its focus to support and work closely with nonprofits in maternal and child health, responsible journalism, water quality, land conservation, and clean energy. My first question for Doug Wilhelm concerns how he became involved in this project and how he came to write Catalysts for Change. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
This is my 18th book, and I don't really know how that happened. But the previous ones have all been for young readers, mostly for middle schools and young adult, which basically means older middle schoolers. I have a couple of books for younger people, but none for adults. And yet, I haven't written for adults forever. I started as a newspaper reporter and editor, and my last real journalism job was covering Vermont for the Boston Globe in the late 80s and early 90s. And I wanted to get off of the journalism treadmill. You know, it is kind of a treadmill. And I wanted to write books. So I figured that I could market my journalism skills, being able to put publications together, being able to interview people, write stories, work with graphic designers and photographers, all that, in service of Vermont nonprofits. That was an idea that I had. I figured that there are a lot of nonprofits in Vermont that need to communicate, and yet most of them are not big enough to have their own communication staff. So I could offer my services, and that actually worked out. I did website work for, I've done it for over 30 years for all kinds of nonprofits and all kinds of different areas, from healthcare to business to environmental and energy, education, you know, everything. So it's been fascinating over the years. I have no idea how many annual reports, newsletters, fundraising materials, and of course, more recently, websites. So I got into writing books for young readers quite a while ago, and that was part of my work. But I continue to do this contract writing and editing work for nonprofits. So all these years later, many, if not most, of the people in Vermont that I've met, and I've met so many and interviewed so many people, most of the people I think that I've really come to admire are people who work at nonprofits. You know, there are so many that are doing really good work and have really bright, really committed, really creative people dedicated to their work who are not making the kind of money that they could make probably in the private sector, but they believe in what they're doing and they want to make a difference. And I've become really admired a lot of those folks. So to cut a long story short, recently in the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 7 years, I did some projects for the Lintelak Foundation, which is a family foundation based in Shelburne. It's a little over 50 years old, and they are well known in Vermont for being a very activist, kind of an unusually activist, hands-on foundation that works in a number of different areas, from women's health to journalism. They're a big supporter of VT Digger in Vermont Public, and also energy and especially environmental work, water quality, big in addressing the cyanobacteria issue in Lake Champlain, and things related to this. So they do quite a lot of different things. And so I did an annual report for them, and I did a couple other projects. And Cree Lintelak is the woman who is the executive director of the foundation, has been for years, a very well-known in Vermont nonprofit and in the state house and, public policy world. So she asked me one day if I would write a history of the foundation, but she said, we don't want it focused on the foundation. We want to focus on the nonprofits that we've worked with and supported, and how have they been able to make a difference in these key areas that are our priorities. So, and I thought, great, what a great project. And the beauty of it was it took me several years. I got to go really in depth into a number of key areas, and the foundation supported the work, but never told me what to do or what to write. They just helped me kind of figure out who to talk with and what the best topic should be. But I was left to do it as best I could, and that was a beautiful thing for me. So that's the story behind the project.
That's fantastic. Now, you may have mentioned this, but I don't know if you did. What was your first interaction with the Lintelak Foundation? Were you doing stuff for them earlier before you had the idea for this? I know that you had an idea about this book before she came to you, but even before that, were you working with them?
Actually, it was her idea.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was before the pandemic. Probably 2017 or sometime around there, 2018, I had a call from Terry Parent, who is a person who is a very, very talented graphic designer and marketing expert who runs a small firm in Burlington called Stride Creative Group. And they do marketing and graphic design work, and they're really, really good. And I really love working with Terry. She's brilliant. And she said to me, the Lintelak Foundation needs a writer. Is it okay if we recommend you? And I said, oh, yeah, sure. Because, of course, I'd heard of them. And they have a great reputation for the work they do. And so I did an annual report for them. And this would have been 2018, I think it came out. And then a couple of other projects. I remember doing a PowerPoint on women in philanthropy for Cree and her daughter, Louise, a grown daughter, who's now Louise is the president of the foundation, but I may be wrong. Anyway, so that was the start of it. And then it was Cree who came to me with the idea of doing a book on the history of the foundation.
All
by
right,
then,
wonderful.
We kind of developed a rapport and enjoyed working together. At least I certainly did.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I wanted to talk. I loved how you began the book in story. And I think one of the things I love so much about this book is, you're not quite sure what you're going to be reading when you pick up a book that's about nonprofits and a foundation. And, that certainly could be a little bit dry, but it wasn't at all. Right. You start right away in the story of Claire Malcolm Lintelak. It really pulled me right in. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that story about Claire and also making the decision to start the book that way.
Yeah. So, well, this is another story. So another project that I did, an earlier book in company with the Lintelaks. The founder of the Lintelak Foundation was a woman named Claire Lintelak that you just mentioned. Claire was born 10 days before the turn of the 20th century in 1899 in rural China. She was the daughter of a Canadian medical missionary who spent his whole career basically in China, attending to the Chinese people, a very devoted guy. And he raised his family, I think four kids total, in in China. And Claire was grew up in China, learned to speak fluent Chinese, and became a healthcare worker herself. She was a nurse, and she was a freelance traveling nurse in the 1920s and 30s, an incredibly turbulent time of civil war and upheaval and all kinds of struggle in China. And she was an amazingly kind of intrepid woman who traveled alone on tramp steamers up and down the coast and had all kinds of adventures, eventually married a British businessman who was based in Shanghai in the chemical industry. And they had one child, and eventually they lived in China until 1950, a year after the communist revolution ended, and finally had to leave when there was no more corporate business in China. And Claire and her husband, Lynn Lintelak, moved to New York City and that would vacation in Vermont in Stowe. And Lynn became an executive with a multinational insurance company and died unexpectedly.
Young, right? Yeah.
He died very young in the late 50s. He had a hip replacement operation and unexpectedly just died in the middle of the night of a lung embolism. And so Claire is left with a teenage boy, and they left New York and moved up to Stowe, Vermont, which they liked. And later in her life, Claire wanted her son, whose name is Phil, to know her story, because he was 10 when they left China. So she wrote an unpublished memoir, and she recorded 15 hours of oral history, just storytelling.
Wow.
And all that sat in a closet for decades. Claire passed away in 1984. And then I get involved all these years later with the foundation and met Phil and his wife, Cree. Phil is still works as a plant biology professor at UVM. He's an amazing guy. And so he says, I want to show you something. And he brings this unpublished manuscript and this spindle of 15 CDs out of a closet and says, this is my mom's story. I think it's a good story. And I thought it was a great story. So we did a book called China in Another Time, A Personal Story, which I took Claire's words and kind of digested them and put them together and edited them into a good story. And so one of the pieces in the book is about an incident that Claire, when she was a brand new, newly minted nurse, been trained in a British hospital in Shanghai, she gets a call literally out of her window in the middle of the night. A man whose wife is in labor and she's in distress, a Chinese guy who lived in a hut, in the city. And she goes and she finds that the wife has delivered the baby on her own, but in her distress to get this baby out, because the baby was in great distress, the birth was difficult, she had reached in, pulled the baby's head out, and gouged out its eyes with her fingers.
This is horrible. Oh my.
A horrible, horrible story. And the baby did not live very long, but Claire continued to be in touch with this family and make sure they were okay. And that was the incident that kind of sparked a lifelong interest in maternity care and safe women's birthing care. And so Claire started the foundation many years later when she's living in Stowe to help bring hospital-based nurse midwifery back into the American healthcare system. She worked with the head of OBGYN at what was then the Burlington Hospital, John Mick. Dr. Mick was the head of OBGYN. So they worked together in the late 70s and the late 60s and early 70s to bring the first nurse midwives into that hospital and among the first to work in American hospital system. Today the birthing center at UVM Medical Center is called the Lintelak Birthing Center. So that was how I started the book, was telling the story of how Claire came to regard maternity care as sort of the passion of her life. And that's with the genesis of the foundation.
Yeah. Just to take one little step back, and then I want to talk about the mother and child care issues that she was so devoted to. But also, I just was really struck by the fact that you are a storyteller, and that even within all of this material, you usually in almost every chapter find a story to tell that really well elucidates what you're trying to convey and what the work is that's been done in these nonprofits. And so are you aware of that as you're writing, that you're always just sort of at your core a storyteller?
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to say, I just so much appreciate that you see that, because that is what is, I guess, my own passion, or my what really matters to me are really good stories. So as a writer, a freelance writer, I always look for the stories to tell, and stories center on people, and people connect with stories. So, you know, that is what I'm always looking for. So in each of these chapters in this book, as you mentioned, each one kind of covers a completely different area, from women's healthcare to journalism to environmental science to land conservation to clean energy. So widely different topics. But in each one, trying to tell the story of nonprofits making change, I tried to find the actual stories that, you know, that would bring that to life, whether they're large ones or small ones or both.
And the thing that's wonderful, too, is that you include a lot of local people, a lot of local, I guess, character. But I have to tell you, as I was reading it, I'm like, oh, Kathy Kelleher, I know her. Oh, Eric Walensky, Kathy? I know him. Oh, Susan Leff, I know her. Uh-huh. So it's like really fun. All these local people that... it's fun to read, because I think that a lot of people would have that experience, because you've just got so many local people in here, and that's great. So how did the foundation actually come into being, like as a legal entity?
Yeah, so Claire, without getting too deeply into this, Claire's husband had worked for this, been an executive for this multinational insurance company that became...
AIG?
AIG, thank you. So he had passed away, but he left Claire with stock in this company. And over the years, that this value, that stock just exploded in value, and she becomes pretty affluent. So she, in living in Stowe, she spent the rest of her life in Stowe. And from, I think, the early 60s, she moves to Stowe to when she dies in 84. She really loves Stowe. And initially, her first cause was to help bring a bike path to Stowe. She was the original supporter of the Stowe bike path, which was, that story is one of those in the book. It was, as far as I could tell, the first recreational outdoor path within a city or a town in America. If not the first, one of them. And so that was groundbreaking. But her real cause was bringing nurse midwifery to the UVM, what's now the UVM Medical Center, then the Burlington Hospital. So she allied with his man, Dr. Meck, who was the head of the OBGYN. And so those two causes, those two projects, Stowe Bike Path and more long-term supporting midwifery at the hospital, those were the ones for which she forms a foundation. It was in 1972, if I'm remembering right, and they incorporated, and she was the head of it, and she had a small board, and that was the initial focus. And the foundation continues in some ways, to lesser ways, to support nurse midwifery. But under her, after she passed away in 84, her son Phil and his wife Cree took over running the foundation. And today they oversee it with their three grown children, Louise, Will, and Paul, all of whom live in Vermont and are very active working in their fields and running the foundation. So the foundation's interests have broadened from nurse midwifery, healthcare, community projects to supporting energy, environment, land conservation, responsible journalism.
Right.
And I think those are the basic topics, and environmental science as well.
Yeah. Now, you have done a lot of research in writing this book, and you did a lot of in-person interviews. And I'm wondering, were all of those done after the fact of deciding to write the book, or had you done some of these interviews earlier and you were able to pull them in?
Oh, that's a good question. I think that because of the work I'd done for years, I knew some of the people who were involved. Some of the people, for example, I did the original first newsletter for VPIRG, the Vermont Public Interest Research Group, way back in the mid-80s. So I knew who VPIRG was. Is and the Vermont Natural Resources Council. I had done some work with them, Middlebury College. I live outside Middlebury. I had done some work with Middlebury College. So I knew some people, but I would say the great, great majority of people that I connected with and interviewed for this, I had never met before. Okay. Yeah, it was looking at the list of grants, who did the foundation support, and finding the most important stories of how nonprofits with more than just funding help. The foundation is very activist, so they work kind of hands-on. They sit on boards, they go to meetings, they're in the State House. They're very involved as a foundation. So it's more of a partnership with nonprofits like some of the key ones, the Conservation Law Foundation, very, very active in clean water work and clean energy work, VNRC, VPIRG, I just mentioned, and the Trust for Public Land and Land Conservation, and a number of others. So yeah. I was familiar with a lot of these, but I learned a whole lot more.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, it's incredible. Now, your background in journalism must have served you really well, especially when you started to write about the focus of the work of the foundation around integrity in journalism. Can you just talk a little bit about that program and what they've done to support that?
Yeah, anybody who's worked in journalism knows that the journalism is really struggling to survive in America. There are hundreds of newspapers, large and small, all across the country that have closed in the last couple of decades. The advent of digital information sharing, Craigslist really undercut the classified ad revenue of newspapers. That was critical. A lot of these factors have been really, really hurtful to newspapers' ability to survive. So you've still got the big papers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, but an awful lot of big cities have lost papers, as well as a lot of towns and communities. So this is a big problem. And how does journalism survive? Because we can't have a democracy. We can't have a functioning republic without responsible journalism that can cover issues, that can hold public officials to account, keep people honest, et cetera, et cetera. It's not an option. We're not going to be okay without journalism. So the foundation has been very involved with supporting nonprofit alternatives to for-profit journalism. Traditional newspapers are for-profit operations, and they're just not making money anymore. So Vermont Public is a nonprofit and has been for years. So the foundation has been one of their supporters. They were supporters both of public radio and public television before they merged. And a key story, that probably the central story to that chapter in my book, is the story of B.T. Digger, which I quoted a journalism professor from NYU who was up a few years ago talking with the staff, newsroom staff of the Burlington Free Press. And he said, well, of course, you guys are still the largest newsroom in Vermont. And they all said, no, we're not. And he said, well, what do you mean? And they said, V.T. Digger is now the largest newsroom staff. And, Ann Galloway, a friend of mine who I admire hugely, had been laid off from her job Barry Montpelier Times Argus, and like so many journalists, but she decided that she was going to start this news website, and she recently pulled back after years of building Vermont V.T. Digger, but she started with just her and an incredible dedication to news and built it up into. And this is I'm rambling a little bit, and I'm sorry, but this is a nonprofit operation supported by grants, but also by people like you and me who are subscribers. And they have managed to build a viable, hopefully sustainable journalistic outlet for Vermont that they were the key investigator of the EB5 scandal.
I think a lot of their journalists actually come from the Free Press after the Free Press scale down, and the Times Argus.
Yeah. The Times Argus and people who come from 7 Days. And, this is an important story because I interviewed Anne and I said, can journalism survive? And she said, yes, as a nonprofit approach, it's possible, but it's not easy. So these are all complex subjects.
Here's a pretty simple question.
Okay.
So you were asked to work on this right before COVID struck. How did COVID affect your progress in writing this book?
I got COVID early on into the spring 2020. So I was down struggling. I wasn't complete. I was only down for a few weeks, but I was struggling to come back for a few months. So that did slow me down. But, you know, it kind of in some ways made it easier because people didn't want to see me in person. Now, I had done an awful lot, most of the research for this book, I think, before COVID struck, but I still had people to talk with. And so I did interviews like this by Zoom, it made it a little bit easier. But as I think back on it, I went all over Vermont talking with people, and I think I had gotten most of the interviewing done before COVID struck. So it was more the writing that I was able to do. And I was very glad to have a project that, during that period that I could focus on and work on.
So let's talk a little bit about lake cleanup efforts and the nonprofits that support lake cleanup.
So people who live along the shore of Lake Champlain and some other lakes like Lake Carmi, I think it's Carmi or Carmi, I'm not sure how you say it, up in northern Vermont, they know that blue-green algae, as it's often called, or cyanobacteria more properly, is a big problem along the, especially in sheltered coves, in bays, and along the edge of Lake Champlain, and especially in the hot summer days, you get this really awful, frothy, kind of soupy, blue-green bloom of algae. And it does not have one cause. It is mainly caused by the overloading of phosphorus into the lake from both farm sources, developed areas, paved roads, lawns, and to a small extent now sewage treatment outflows. Mm-hmm. And it is a big problem all around the world. And so in Vermont, the Linilac Foundation played a really big role in focusing public attention on this. They supported a documentary that aired on public television right around the time that Governor Shumlin came into office. And that was, when was that, Sheila? That was...
Shumlin would have been, oh, wow, like 2008 or...
2010. The Linilacs worked with a small Vermont video production company to do this, produce this film on the cyanobacteria problem in Lake Champlain. And it really focused a lot of it. It was called Bloom, and it won an Emmy and a regional Emmy. And it focused a lot of attention and caused a lot of debate and discussion on this issue, and sort of helped to push the state government into addressing this. Now, among the nonprofits, the big actor here is the Conservation Law Foundation, which went to court again and again and again and again to help to force the state to take more direct action. And finally, the state did pass a new Clean Water Act that is very ambitious and finally has allocated sustainable, long-term, multi-million dollar funding to address this, which does not mean the problem has been solved, but it means that a major commitment has been made to addressing it in different areas, like curbing phosphorus runoff from farm fields, from paved areas, all kinds of different ways that this problem is contributed to.
Okay. All right. Great. I wanted to ask you, Doug, a little bit about the structure of the book. I said that you are very much a storyteller. You also have interviews, you have photographs, you have more journalistic pieces. So how did you decide to structure the book, and did you have input from an editor?
Yeah. Okay, so what I did basically was to go through the list of grants over the years, who has the foundation supported, and looked at and try to find the big stories there. The cyanobacteria story is a good example. This is a very big story. Another big story that there are two chapters in the last two chapters in the book covers is the push toward a clean energy economy in Vermont. The first of the chapters describes the years-long push to retire the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant in Vernon, Vermont. And the second chapter describes the complex and multi-actor effort to shift Vermont more and more toward a clean energy economy. And this involves government and private sector and nonprofits as well, and academics. Very complicated, as you know, and very, very important, obviously, in this age of climate change. That's what this is all about. Mm-hmm. So, these were obviously big stories. The story of helping journalism find a new way to survive, another big story. So I just, as a person sort of trained in looking for the stories that matter, that's what I did. I looked for them, and I sort of outlined the book, and with help from Creel Intellect and the foundations, who should I talk with about these stories? Who are the most important people? And it, not just at the foundation, but in state government, in academia, who are the people that can really shed light on this? I wasn't trying to portray nothing but positive news. These are complex stories, and was trying to portray a realistic account of how positive change can be made on long-term, complex, challenging issues, and in the context of the challenges generally continue. Journalism has not figured out completely how to survive. The lake is not completely cleaned up. We are far from achieving a truly clean energy economy, but we've made real progress in these areas. And those are the stories, and that's how I tried to approach it.
Okay, great. And as far as an editor goes, did you have...
Oh, yeah, the editor, right. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. I know I'm asking a lot of questions.
I worked with a wonderful editor in Western Mass who had edited Michelle Obama's book. And that was through a publisher in New York that I had worked with on a previous book. I said, I need a really good editor. And they said, oh, this person is great. So I found her, and she was fantastic. So, and then we worked with a proofreader, copy editor in central Vermont, who I knew and thought a lot of. So, yeah, a book needs an editor. As a writer, you get so close to the material, and you absolutely have to have somebody with expertise in helping you shape and hone down and pare down the book. And obviously, there were a lot of factual stuff in here that had to be checked and verified, and that was a long process that we did. So we worked with two editors on that.
Yeah.
Annabelle Sorgas is her name. I think she's in Berrytown. Okay. Very, very good editor, if anybody's looking for one.
Okay. All right. Awesome. I always like to ask my guests if they've read anything lately that they would recommend to listeners. What are you reading these days that you've enjoyed?
I am working on a completely different project. I'm thinking about a mystery novel for young adults.
Oh, cool.
So I'm reading a lot of mysteries, detective crime novels. And that is really interesting for me. Talk about storytelling, how you put together a crime novel with a crime, something really bad has happened and hurtful, as somebody's been killed or something, somebody's been hurt or something has been stolen at the heart of this. And then how does the detective or person acting as a detective find the solution? It's really a classic storytelling form. And so I'm thinking about a middle school sort of crime novel in which a couple of students become sort of the detectives. So I've been reading a lot of Scandinavian mysteries and American mysteries, and just finished a British mystery, and now reading one set in the outback in Australia. So
can you give us any titles?
Oh gosh. So here's the one author that I really, really like best among the number I've read is, it's an Icelandic name. I'm not going to say it right. Arnaldur Indridason, and Indridason. And he is very popular, he's written a number of really, really good detective novels set in Iceland.
Oh, cool.
So that's the guy I've found, and I've liked a number of the Norwegian and Swedish Scandinavian crime novelists as well.
Yeah.
But that guy is right. So far, that guy's I'm really admiring his work.
Okay, cool. Joe Nesbo comes to mind, but I'm not sure.
Yes, I read Joe Nesbo, the Harry Hole stories. Yeah, right. Alcoholic detective, really good. Yeah, and there's some other ones as well.
Yeah.
But I would recommend Indridison. And luckily, I was able to remember his name. I don't seem to be very good at remembering names this morning.
How do you feel they've done at continuing the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo series? Is that new author?
I read the series itself, but I have not read the follow-up by the new author.
Neither.
You know, I'm kind of like hesitant. How could those be as good as the originals were?
Right. Which is,
have you read those books?
I haven't read the continuation of the series since the first three. And the poor author, I'm sure, is an incredibly talented author. They wouldn't have chosen him. On the other hand, he's doing quite well, I'm sure. So I'm not feeling
how
sorry.
Can you? Yeah, I'm sure he's compensated well for it. But how can you ever, I wouldn't want to be in that position.
Right.
It's not you, you know, the best books come through you and they're the book only you could write. And this is a book somebody else wrote.
Yeah.
So, or a series that somebody else wrote. How do you measure up to that?
Right. Exactly.
But if they offered me all that kind of money that I'm sure they offered that person, I probably would have taken on the challenge.
Exactly. Right. You're going to feel fine about it.
Oh, I'll do my best.
Now, I see that Catalyst for Change is published by Rootstock Publishing,
yes.
Which is in central Vermont. I'm very interested in the publishing industry these days, people's stories of finding a publisher. How did you approach finding a publisher and settling with Rootstock? And what was your experience like of a hybrid publisher?
Yeah, so to explain, a hybrid publisher is an emerging, fast-growing model in the publishing world that it's really publishing it. Book publishing is another industry that's changed so much in the digital age. And, I'm sure you know, there are only five big, huge corporate publishers left. They've conglomerated so many of the longstanding names in publishing into five huge multinational owned corporations, five huge publishing houses owned by multinational corporations. And so that has sort of commercialized, I think, and the industry in ways that books that don't fit accepted or formulas for success tend not to get an opportunity with those big publishers. And so a lot of authors have been looking for other ways to publish. And I have tried self-publishing. I brought out three books that way. It's exhausting. You're on your own. It's expensive. You're likely to lose money. You keep bringing out books, but it's tough.
Right.
So hybrid publishing is a merging of commercial, traditional, and self-publishing in the middle, where the author helps to support the cost of the work, you know, the editing and the graphic design and printing, but you work with a professional team of a real publisher, a small publisher, but a real publisher. You're not on your own. And so it's a pretty interesting, in many ways, very viable approach. And it's really growing in the publishing world. And I think it's gaining respect. I brought out an earlier book, a novel for young adults and adults called Street of Storytellers. That was how I found Rootstock and worked with them. That book came out in 2019 and it won three national and one New England awards for independently published books. So,
that
Rootstock is a high quality small publishing firm based in Montpelier. They have a number of books. It's rootstockpublishing.com. If you can look at their catalog and they're publishing nonfiction as well as fiction. So I had a great experience with them. When Catalyst for Change was in development, Rootstock also brought out Claire Linilak's book, China in Another Time. So I had done two books with them. And so we had worked really closely together. So it was kind of a natural choice with Catalyst to bring it to them. And they do a superb job. They're very, very good. A number of Vermont writers have brought out books now with them, some people I know. And I think you're never 100% happy with any publisher because, you know, most books don't become bestsellers. And so, you know, could we have done a better job? Could we have done more? Could we have done differently? Writers are always struggling with that. But I have to say that in in general, I've been really happy with Rootstock. And, you know, they open up and they've helped to open up new pathways to publishing. Mm-hmm. And you have to have those pathways for writers to emerge and find their way and bring books out that can find an audience. If we just have five huge corporate publishers in the world, you know, I don't think those pathways are going to be open to most people. So yeah. Anyway, that's why I think this is a really great thing.
Okay, cool. Great. I just have one last question for you, Doug. And I always like to ask for advice for other writers. Uh-huh. And uh-huh. I'm wondering if you can offer some advice. You clearly had the Lintellex support as you know, sort of like their professional support, their interest in this book being written. And yet you say that they left you a certain amount of autonomy. They weren't super involved in telling you what to write or what to do. Wondering if you have advice for people who might be interested in this kind of path, working with an organization or working with an individual to bring out that story, but staying independent. Do you have any advice along those lines?
Well, you know, that's an interesting and difficult question to answer in a general way. I have been a freelance writer working mainly for organizations, most of the nonprofits in Vermont for over 30 years. Mm-hmm. So I have done an awful lot of less glamorous work. And most of my work is not books, but like I said before, newsletters, annual reports, websites, stuff that has to be done. But what happens is through that work, you develop relationships with organizations and you develop a reputation for being able to work with people. And I think that helped me to come on to the radar screen of the Lintellex Foundation and have them feel that I could do it. I think that what is really key in that for me is those skills that I developed early in my career working on newspapers. I went to work for community weekly papers, and I was a reporter and then an editor, and then later on I worked for the Globe in Vermont as I was actually a what's called a stringer or a correspondent on a freelance reporter on regular assignment. So I developed these skills. How do you find the story? How do you recognize a story? How do you tease it out? How do you gather the facts? How do you write something that on deadline that is interesting and engaging for readers? How do you work with photographers or in layout artists? All those skills I developed in the newspaper world and then brought that to this business that I've been doing for all these years. So I think the key answer is, how do you build the skills? Because somebody who says, I'm going to hang out my shingle without any training, maybe they've written a blog for a while, but nobody edits a blog. You really have to work with experienced editors who are going to help hammer you into shape and help you learn the lessons of experience that you need. And so that's why one of the reasons for young writers, why I think the survival of journalism is so important, because you get those skills online best by working in community journalism. Here in Addison County, where I live, we have the Addison Independent, which is an absolutely superb newspaper. And if I were steering a young person today, I'd say, find an Addison Independent. Go to work for a community paper. You're not going to make much money, but the skills you're going to develop will be absolutely invaluable. And even for writing fiction, it's all about storytelling, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. So that would be my basic answer.
That's wonderful. Okay, that's great. I want to mention again, the name of the book is Catalysts for Change, How Nonprofits and a Foundation Are Helping Shape Vermont's Future by Doug Wilhelm, who's been my guest today, published by Rootstock. Doug, thank you so much for talking to me about your book.
And thanks, Shayla. I just want to say how much I appreciate the work you do. I know this is the second time we've had an interview and years have passed between the two, and you've been doing this all this time and interviewing authors and helping to highlight books and helping us to reach audiences. It really matters. And I really appreciate it. Thank you for the thoughtful questions. And thank you for the chance to talk in some depth about this book. I really, really appreciate it.
That was super nice of him to say. And a little self-serving for me to leave it in there. But oh well, that was nice. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV-LP. Burlington, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Doug Wilhelm about his new book, Catalysts for Change, How Nonprofits and a Foundation Are Helping Shape Vermont's Future, published by Rootstock. You can learn more about his work at DougWilhelm.com, although the most recent book, The Catalyst for Change, there's more information about that book actually on Rootstock.com. You can also find my earlier interview with Doug about a book that he wrote for young readers. That's on the podcast site. This week's Write the Book prompt was kindly suggested by my guest, Doug Wilhelm, who thinks about stories all the time, he says. Find one observation, something you have overheard or seen, something that stood out for you for whatever reason, and make a story from it. This can be a piece of conversation, part of an argument. It can be an interesting person who stood out to you. Take note of this small observation and start writing. Doug says story involves tension, so see what tension might emerge from what you began with, and then see if that tension is going to resolve somehow as you work out the story. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. The Green Mountain Book Festival is coming up the weekend of September 23rd, 24th, 25th. It's a weekend of literary celebration and community. There's going to be so much going on. The headliner is Ruth Ozeki, who's also been on the show. Ruth's latest book is The Book of Form and Emptiness, and she will be the headliner for the Green Mountain Book Festival. There will also be many panels, many readings from celebrated authors from Vermont and outside of Vermont. GreenMountainBookFestival.org, and you can find out much, much more than I've just said. There's way too much to tell you. So anyway, that's something to think about in case you might be interested. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. If you like the show, please rate it where you get your podcasts. Like it on Facebook and talk about it. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and also about the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com. It's also available wherever you get your podcasts. Just subscribe and the episodes will be sent to you. You can also visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook, and you can access the podcast at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. I told that to somebody recently, a new friend, and he was horrified, and I had to explain it's how you spell my name, She Laughs, and then you take out the U and the S, and it spells Shayla. Anyway, I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org. Stay well and have a great week.